Brooklyn, and beyond to the world. Peace, love, and rock and roll.
Those seeking freedom, to those committed to abolishing slavery, to those who want liberation for all. This is a message from the revolutionary abolitionist movement. The United States was built on slavery, and despite the American Civil War, this oppression never ended. The abolitionist movement fought against this tyranny. Modern slavery and mass brutality persists unchecked. Fascism is on the rise. The state has openly declared war on our communities, threatening to ethnically cleanse Latinos, criminalize Muslims, destroy indigenous land, and oppress the LGBT community while continuing to murder and incarcerate black people. The revolutionary abolitionist movement unequivocally states the plantation system must be destroyed. Today, the anarchist struggle and anti-statist feminism are flourishing, and authoritarian modes of resistance have been discredited. The Rojava revolution in northern Syria has set a new standard with a foundation in feminism, ecology, anti-state organizing, and armed struggle. It has actualized the path towards liberation beyond 20th century nationalism. With the founding of groups like the International Revolution of People's Guerrilla Forces, it is clear that this is the time for anarchist revolutionaries to act without hesitation. We declare our solidarity with the international fascist and anarchist struggle and propose concrete steps in the fight for abolition. Revolutionary abolitionists must fight hand in hand with those facing oppression. We intend to establish a new underground railroad to free people from bondage by building revolutionary self-defense networks, connecting them to one another, and developing militant strategies in their neighborhoods. Our network will create the capacity to destroy state power and defend our communities. A new global paradigm for revolution has been established to be taken up by dedicated revolutionaries, autonomous territories, guerrillas in armed struggle, and all those engaged in the global drive towards liberation and away from statehood, capitalism, patriarchy, and domination. We call on anti-state revolutionary groups to join the revolutionary abolitionist movement and send this message to our comrades to help build the capacity to burn down the American plantation once and for all. Welcome to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. This is your host and comrade, Sergio Castillo. We are here live on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome, 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 comrades, to another edition of Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. I am your host and comrade, Sergio Castillo. As always, a few announcements from Radio Free Brooklyn. As you know, COVID-19 has disrupted all of our lives, and we at Radio Free Brooklyn are no different. So we would greatly appreciate any generous donation that you can make. You can go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. In order to do anything you can, we are a nonprofit organization. If you'd like to listen to Radio Free Brooklyn where you're not in front of your computer, please download our mobile app for iPhone and Android, available in the App Store for iPhone or the Google Play Store for Android. Please be sure to subscribe to our monthly newsletter for the latest news about new programming and upcoming Radio Free Brooklyn events. And yes, that is the ice cream truck in the background. You can sign up at radiofreebrooklyn.org/newsletter. I'm probably sure y'all can hear that. And there's that. Our guest today marks another chapter in our program's journey to freedom and liberation. He is an actor, writer, current MFA candidate, and our program's first Canadian. In the theater, he has been featured in The Three Musketeers, A Doll's House, Forever Yours, Mary Lou, by Michel Tremblay, Cymbeline. He has studied a wide range of indigenous Canadian playwrights, which I, of course, will ask him about, as well as many dramatists from the 19th and 20th century. In 2019, he became an MFA candidate at the Actors Studio Drama School, Pace University. Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio is proud to welcome Andrew James Young. Andrew, welcome to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio.
Hi there. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So where to begin? Perhaps at the beginning. Andrew, where were you born?
I was born in Toronto, Canada.
What was your father's name?
My father's name was Ian Young.
What was his occupation?
He currently runs his own company right now.
What was your mother's name?
Deborah Young.
And what was her occupation?
She is actually an executive within the TJX Canada Corporation, which is like TJ Maxx, Marshalls, but Canadian.
Did art play a significant role for you as a child?
I would say yeah and no. I mean, I was very lucky. My parents would bring my brother and I to theater. Occasionally, we had a family tradition of going to pantomime every Christmas, which, you know, I fell in love with. In Toronto, there's a guy named Ross Petty who puts on these pantomimes every year and is incredible. But yeah, my brother, who's 7 years older, actually was into acting, and so I basically just copied him.
What was the name of your elementary school?
My elementary school was Lambton Kingsway.
What was the name of your middle school?
Same school. It was a K-8 school.
Ah, I see. Yeah. What high school did you attend?
Etobicoke School of the Arts in Etobicoke.
When did you discover that theater and film would play a significant role in your life?
I think from a very young age. You know, being able to see my brother, who also went to the high school that I did. You know, I remember seeing he was in a production of Midsummer, and I was very young, and seeing him on stage and how much fun he was having, I was like, I want to do that. I want to be a part of that. And when I was in the third grade, was this minor role, like didn't even have a speaking role in our school play. But I just improvised like ridiculous sort of physical comedy bits without really thinking, because I didn't have, you know, the ability to self-critique at that age. And I remember coming off the stage and my brother was like, oh, you stole the show. And I was like, yeah, this is what I'm doing. Yeah. And since then, you know, my passions, you know, waned and gotten stronger, but it's stronger now than it's ever been.
So it was then when you knew you'd pursue it professionally?
Yeah. I think it was, I remember the moment. It was in a class that I actually ended up dropping. I was in grade 11 and I had a class with a high school teacher whose name is Darren Black, who really, really influenced me. And it was this class that I remember I was going to, and I loved every second of this class, and it really re-sparked my passion for acting, because doing it every day in my first 3 years of high school, I, you know, I lost a bit of the enchantment with it. And he brought it back for me, and I ended up dropping it for chemistry, because, you know, I wanted to leave my options open, and here I am now.
Well, it's a bug that doesn't let go, does it?
Yeah.
What college did you attend?
I went to McGill University in Montreal.
Did they have a theater department?
So McGill is interesting. Technically, they do, but it's primarily dramaturgy. So there's pretty much, I believe, one class every year that deals essentially only in performance, and they'll rotate. I can't remember what the other class called, but I took one. It was the production when we did Cymbeline. It was from that class. So the first, it's a full year class. In the first semester, you study Shakespeare and you study the play, and then we studied Cymbeline very in depth and made the cuts ourselves in class, and then we were cast, and the next semester we put it on, and it became my favorite Shakespeare play because it's wild.
I believe it's Brecht's favorite play as well.
Oh, no way.
I think, and Hitler's. I'm pretty sure that's the case. That's a weird thing to say. Anyway, in 2019, you made a significant choice to move to New York and study at the Actors Studio Drama School at Pace University.
Yeah.
What inspired this decision?
So, you know, being at a university for 4 years, I went to university to get an undergrad in history because, you know, my parents wanted me to have a backup plan. And, you know, I have no regrets on doing that. But I for the longest time, I thought I was going to graduate and then just move back to Toronto and try to act. But I kind of, you know, the more that I learned at McGill, the more I was like, the more I realized I didn't know. And I thought the same had to be true for acting. And I'm so glad that I did that because it's, you know, even just outside of like what I learn at school, being able to be surrounded by incredible artists all the time is and have like important conversations is has been super helpful for me and my growth. Yeah.
What drew you to the method?
I always think that I would, you know, try to use a little bit of a diluted method when I was younger. And, you know, didn't have a system for myself. But, you know, I would always try to think about the character as an extension of myself. I would always think that it's, you know, it's like a part of me lives in this character lives in my hand. And this is a terrible metaphor, but a part of the character lives in my hand. And so I just have to become my entire body has to become my hand. And so I would try to inhabit the characters that way. And that's what kind of drew me to the method, is that complete immersion and artistry that comes along with it.
Well, I had an acting teacher once say acting, a lot of it is, you know, taking the hand of your 12-year-old self and playing, you know, with the inner child of yourself.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Actors Studio Drama School.
Ooh, general question. The Actors Studio Drama School is a really cool program. In your first year, you focus more on learning sensory work, the different aspects of it, the different, you know, ways you can go about it. And you don't really do any scenes until the end.
Enormous amount of preparation.
Yeah. And so that year is basically just like, you know, you come in, you try to unlearn all of those terrible habits that you had, find the good ones that you had and mix them in with the method and sort of create your own method. And then the second year, which I'm currently in, you start doing more. You start actually, you know, acting in short plays and in short scenes and start applying that work. It's just a really incredible space. I mean, you know, for all of these sort of administrative difficulties and headaches that come along with, you know, being in a post-grad, it has so much value I think anybody, really, you know, we have people in the program who don't necessarily want to pursue acting, but pursue things like, you know, dramatic therapy and like how can, you know, acting and art serve as a method of healing. And how can sensory work to help that? And so I think acting is the study of human behavior and the study of humans. And so I think every single person can genuinely learn something from it and take something from it, even if they just do it for fun. Yeah.
I've always wanted to ask this, or not always. I guess in the last few years I've been wanting to ask someone who is in a university, because I've been out of academia for a while now, for a good like 10 years, and I'm trying to age myself, which is a little nice. But what I wanted to ask is, like, in terms of what we've seen in the last few years with the kind of the social climate changing and the social unrest we've been seeing, a lot of that has been trickling into the university campuses, and not only in terms of being aware of what's happening in the streets, but trying to change curriculums to be more inclusive. Where do you find that's happening in at the Actors Studio or at Pace in general, or is that happening also in Canada? Because I was always kind of curious about like the Idle No More movement, if that has been like kind of trickling into the university campus mm-hmm. as well in terms of establishing that history as a curriculum.
Yeah, so I think I'll take that in two different answers. At the Actors Studio, yes and no. So I think that there's a lot of work being done to try to increase diversity within our faculty and within our students. However, you know, we had last year, when I wasn't there, I believe some faculty of color. And now we have a movement teacher, Yoko,
yes,
who is
good friend of mine. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's incredible. Yeah, she's so great. Much fun. But I believe she is currently like one of the only minority faculty members. And so I think, but at the same time, our theater history curriculum has been changed from reading Ibsen forever, like five Ibsen plays in a row, like to, you know, being able to learn about things like Zoot Suit and An Octoroon and more contemporary playwrights from a variety of different backgrounds, which is so important because it's like before that, you're almost ignoring their contributions to the art. And to the sort of canon of Western society. Yes, we are trying. And I think it's this kind of steady process. You know, like a cliched metaphor, but like Rome wasn't built in a day. And, you know, so like, I think we're putting the bricks down piece by piece, and we just need to keep pushing to keep building, because if we let up, then it's not going to be done. And in terms of in Canada, I think it's a little bit difficult to talk for the entirety of the country, especially because I went to a very liberal, like leftist school.
I'm assuming you speak for everybody in Canada.
Yes. There's not that many of us. We all
like one or two, right?
Yeah, we all know each other, and you know, like. My university's male athletics team was called the Redmen. And, you know, our university tried to defend it by saying it wasn't about that. It was about the color, like, because McGill is red and white. The students were like, yeah, okay, just fucking change it. And, you know, it was a push that happened for a long time, and they eventually did change it. But, you know, even on university campuses, it's such a difficult thing because there are so many people with different sort of opinions on how to get things done. I think a vast majority of people at McGill would, you know, sympathize with sort of minority struggles and believe that change needed to happen. And I think there's just a bit of a disagreement on how that happens and to what degree that happens. I think sometimes debate, while it's super crucial, can get in the way of real change. You know, if we just spend all of our time talking about how are we going to change things, then we're never going to change anything. But I think, you know, Canada, there is, I think, a more populist support for this, which is good in some ways, but bad because Canadians have this idea that we are this multicultural quilt, and they have pushed this sort of propagandized version, vision of Canada, and it basically makes people forget about Canada's own horrible racist history. You know, we followed the U.S. in so many policies, like when in 1882, when the U.S. passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, Canada followed. And we followed them when they, in World War II, when that act was lifted, we followed that as well. And we have our own dark legacy with residential school systems and the indigenous genocide. And I think there are a lot of people in Canada who don't want to acknowledge that happened because they think for one reason or another that, you know, the intentions were good when they just haven't done their research, because if you look at the intentions, like, there's a quote, I believe it's from Sir John A. Macdonald, who was our first prime minister, who like started the residential school systems. And he said the goal was to take the Indian out of the child. And, you know, they went about that brutally. And so while I think Canada is a generally more accepting place, subversive forms of racism and oppression still exist, especially for our Indigenous peoples. I think they make up this figure might be outdated now, but I remember at one point they made up 4% of the Canadian population and 35% of the Canadian prison population, which is ridiculous. So we have our own issues, but we like to tell ourselves that we don't.
Do you tend to be attracted to this kind of almost activist theater, or do you tend to, like, what's the criteria for projects you like to work on?
So I don't like to hold myself to sort of one vision or one thing, because, you know, we're human beings and we have a vast array of differences. You know, I'm a big believer in art for art's sake, and just creating art for the purpose of, you know, beauty or a laugh. And I also realize that that's coming from a place of privilege, because, you know, there's Brandon Jacob Jenkins, who wrote an Octoroon. He has in the prologue of that play, he talks about the fact that he couldn't write a play without people assuming that it had some sort of social agenda. He writes a play about farm animals, and it's like, oh, this is about, you know, black people's oppression in America. And he's like, no, it's just about fucking animals. And so, like,
and to our listeners, Brandon Jacob Jenkins, in my opinion, is the best and most important living playwright in America today. But please continue.
No, he's absolutely incredible. I recently just read that play for the first time, and it became my favorite play. But yeah, so, like, it's coming from a place of privilege to be able to say, like, I don't want to write social activist theater or film or TV, because, you know, I have that privilege. I am able to do that without people automatically assuming that my intentions, unless I make them overt and on the nose and hammer it home, I can do that because I'm white. And, so I don't want to hold myself to one thing, because I love writing comedy. That's just like the pilot that I recently filmed, and we're working on editing and hoping to submit to Tribeca, you know, fingers crossed, knock on wood. My goal for that was just write something absurd, something silly, something that, you know, is just ridiculous and people can just enjoy. But I didn't go about it with a social message. And then I've written plays that, you know, I have a one act play that is about a real conversation that happened during World War II. And, is about, you know, shared human emotion and shared human connection. And there is a bit of a message in that play. And so I don't, you know, I 100% agree with, you know, activist theater. I fucking love activist theater. Personally, as an artist, I don't feel the need to always pursue that.
What is the responsibility of the artist to political discourse?
So it kind of follows up my conversation about, I don't think artists have responsibilities to anyone, really. I think as an artist, your only responsibility is to yourself as an artist, and your message, whatever that is or isn't. Because I think the second we start defining art as, like, this is what you have to do, it becomes something that it isn't. It becomes constricted and not freeing. I had a guy once try to sorry, this is like, this visibly, like, boils my blood.
No, this is some sensory work, right?
Yeah.
This is some sense memory.
he tried to tell me that no piece of art, whether it's film, TV, or, like, as much as a song, isn't good unless you make it with a specific message in mind, with, like, a specific, like, social message in mind. And that, like, that he also tried to call it post-postmodernism, and which is which is like I wrote that guy off. I couldn't even handle that conversation. But I think that, you know, if you are, I think the only real responsibility we have as artists is to show the world as we see it, or as we want it to be seen, or as we want it to be. And you can go about that however you want. And if that is a social message, I feel like if you show the world as it is, it's inevitable that there's going to be a social message. But I don't think that there has to be, you know, because that it goes back to, it puts restrictions on art, which that's a niche for me.
Do you think it's important to study acting formally?
Yes, I do. In some ways, yes. I just think if you are going to be an actor, you need to have a method. You need to have some sort, not like the method, but you need to have a method. You need to have a system. You need to have a technique, something that even if you don't go to school and you build it on your own. I think that's what you need. Because I can't imagine, you know, you just show up and you're yourself every time. Like, that's what I'm assuming, like, because I know that I wouldn't be able to transform myself into, you know, like a Nazi into a husband who, like, cares about his wife and is getting cheated on. I couldn't, you know, like a serial killer versus this, like, I couldn't play all of these different roles that I'm currently and past have played. If I didn't have this training, if I didn't have the ability to become something more than myself within myself, if that makes sense. That sounds,
well, yeah. It's in terms of pulling out things in yourself that you didn't know were there, or, mm-hmm. I mean, when the mind forgets, the body remembers. I mean, we store emotion in our bodies. Sometimes we don't realize where or why.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's, for me, it's like a lot of tension in the shoulders and the upper neck, like, 'cause there's a lot of this because of, well, you know, life. but that's the thing. I think it's about exploring what it means to be human. Like, literature defines what it means to be human, and theater, I think, shows us what it means to be human.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. But again, that doesn't have to be a constricted definition. It can be open, because there is no solid definition of what art is.
Yeah, for sure. I think I had a teacher in high school who said, you know what the word of the dictionary that has the most has the longest passage? It's the word art. It has the most definitions, because it's something that sort of almost escapes definition in a way. And I think, like, a lot of modern visual artists are push that boundary every day about, you know, what is art? Like that, the banana that was taped to the wall or a piece of canvas that sold for like a crazy exorbitant amount of money. And, you know, I'm not hating on it. I didn't do enough research into, you know, what the message of that piece was, but, it is, you know, I mean, like, it's, I think there's also a tendency for people to be like, well, that's not art. Like, I could have done that. And it's like, well, you didn't think of it. You didn't do it. And, like, that's, you know, what artists do is they do things they, you know, they try things out, they experiment, and they push boundaries.
But there's also an elitist nature to some of that, though, because I remember when Tilda Swinton laid in a glass box in a museum, I remember kind of getting mad because it showed the kind of, you know, the status and privilege that she had, because I thought to myself, oh, you know, if a migrant worker from Mexico said, I want to propose this idea, they tell them to fuck off. You know, not everyone has that, can do that. Or what was it, Marina Abramović, who is the racist present person. She was just sitting in a chair looking at people and just staring at it. She's like, well, we do that in acting class. You know what I mean? It's not like,
yeah,
it's, this is nothing. But the thing is, like, the art market itself is such, it's seen so much as a, money scam, because you can't put a price on something, and so much money is funneled through the art industry. That actually a lot of illegal activity actually happens in it, which I was surprised to learn.
I mean, like, yeah, that's like, in terms of the elitism, that's one of the things I hate the most in within art, is like pretentiousness and elitism within art. You know, one of my inspirations is Oscar Wilde, is so many people's is, and for a lot of reasons, but you know, one of my favorite sort of anecdotes about him is the fact that he also hated pretentiousness within art. And so he would actively tell people that it was his books and his plays, they were easy to write. He wrote them in like one sitting or whatever. It was the easiest thing ever, when really he would labor over every word, but he wanted people to think that it was easy for him because he wanted to trivialize it. It's like, and I think that's hilarious. And also, yeah, I just, you know, there are actors who say, like, this is the hardest job in the world. Like we put ourselves out there every day. And it's like, okay, like, yeah, like it's difficult in some senses, but it's like, at the end of the day, you're doing this because you love it. And I don't feel like it's that hard. Like, you know, like, it is, and you have to put in a lot of work, but how can you say that it's the hardest job in the world when there are people, like, who, you know, spend 13 plus hours in an office, or 12 plus hours working hard labor, or,
I think people who have never worked say things like that. Yeah. They've never worked a day in their lives, which is why they can be that pretentious about how difficult, you know, art is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's beyond me.
I mean, do you think that theater is still relevant in the age of the digital revolution?
Yeah, for sure. Because theater presents something different than what TV and film do. Theater is this, you know, it's in the moment. You are right there. You can't pause it. You can't stop. You can't walk away. You know, you're there. And you are, and because you're there, because the actors are there, you can experience emotions that you could almost never through film or TV, because you're seeing and feeling like the energy from their tragedy or their comedy. And there's also things that you can do on the stage you can't do in on film and TV, and the same goes, it's vice versa. Like, there are things you can do on film and TV that you can't do in the theater. But I think theater has this incredibly important part. But I think there's a lot of people who kind of have hesitancy towards theater, because in a conversation with one of my friends, I liken theater, going to live theater, is like sifting for gold. You know, you're going to see a lot of theater that, you know, you're like, why did I pay this much for this? Or great, I've seen that exact same thing a million times. But when you find that gold nugget, oh, changes everything.
Yeah, I was having a conversation. I was doing a lecture / conversation with a professor about like anarchism, and one of the things we talked about was this idea of how out of reach so much of theater is, and that, you know, I worked for TKTS for like a minute, and I remember this saying, like, the cheapest tickets for a Broadway show were like $80. You know, like, a guy who has like a family of four can't afford something like that. It's so out of his reach, and it can't even really be guaranteed that it'll be good.
I mean
they're much more likely to get something more entertaining on Netflix watching Breaking Bad or Squid Game or something, which they know is good.
And if it isn't good, then they can just turn it off. They can watch something else.
In theater, it's become so inaccessible to the masses. And it's only kind of catering to also one voice. I mean, do you see, in terms of, I mean, I know you're still a student mm-hmm. in the university, but like, from your observations, do you see the climate changing in terms of not only representation, but the types of stories we are telling now?
I see. That's a tough question, because, you know, being a student, I haven't been able to see a lot of theater because it's expensive. I feel like, on like some of the major major stages, like, we still aren't really getting that diversity, you know? And I feel like it is changing, but it's kind of like we're still stuck because a lot of the executives, a lot of the producers, a lot of the people with money are still stuck in this sort of old way of thinking. And there's a quote from True Detective where Woody Harrelson says to his father-in-law, he goes, I can't remember what the father-in-law says to spark this, but Woody Harrelson goes, you know what? I bet every old man throughout time has said that, but old men die and the world moves on. And that's what I think kind of needs to happen, not only in theater, but in the world. We just need some old men to fucking die so we can move on and start putting in the progressive policies that we need to start creating the theater that shows a diverse range of you know, people, of lives, of stories. Because I you know, there's a people say like, oh, there's every story has already been told. And I don't like that. Like, maybe, but I'm not willing to accept that. Like, I'm going to keep trying to experiment, to find the stories that have been told before, to find those forms, to subvert expectations, because I think that's, you know, my goal as an actor is to continue pushing and to continue learning and creating new things and new stories, because, yeah, I'm just not willing to accept that every story has been told.
You've studied Indigenous Canadian playwrights, and mm-hmm. can you talk to us about that? I mean, was this something that was you had to seek out, or was this something that was developed in your curriculum? And tell us about the content of the Indigenous playwrights in Canada.
Yeah, so I enrolled in a class called I think it was Canadian Dramatic Theater or something, and I showed up on the first day and. It was actually a Canadian Indigenous theater course. And it was a really incredible and eye-opening sort of experience because there's so much that we just don't talk about in terms of how Canadians treat our Indigenous people. And the content of playwrights, it ranges super, super widely. You know, there is content that deals with the ramifications of the residential school system. And I mean, I feel like the residential school system is very prevalent in most Indigenous theater because it is ingrained into the Indigenous people. Like people think it's this ancient thing, but the last group of kids to be taken from their parents was in the 60s scoop. And, you know, I think the last one of these schools wasn't closed until like the 90s. And so it's just like this generational trauma that is still so alive. And then, you know, you'll get stories of, you know, people on reservations. There's a great play called Res Sisters by Thompson Highway, who's incredible. He's got a bunch of incredible plays. And, you know, it's a story about these women who just have dreams beyond what's sort of attainable for them. There's also like, I got to see this production actually. So there's a playwright called Yvette Nolan, who is an Indigenous Canadian playwright. And she was the writer in residence at our school for a semester or a year, whatever it was. And she put on a production of her adaptation of Aristophanes' The Birds. And, I had decided to take the semester off to focus on stand-up comedy, so I did an audition for it, kicking myself now because it was one of the most incredible pieces of theater I got to see at that school. And it basically takes the story of, you know, these two people come up and they enter the land of the birds. And, you know, they start getting along with the birds and the birds are being friendly to them. But slowly they start, you know, changing the things, you know, they're like, oh, you guys could use like some buildings. And it's this gorgeous sort of metaphor for colonialism. And it's, you know, it's sometimes it's subtle and sometimes it's on the nose, but it was an incredible production and a very interesting play. And so I think it's just something that I think these playwrights need a platform where they can, you know, host these stories. And then this is, sorry, I just thought of this, but there's another play called Pig Girl. I believe it's by Colleen Murphy. I hope it is. But Colleen Murphy is a white woman who wrote this play called Pig Girl, and it was fairly controversial, but also incredibly powerful. It's a play, it's a true story. There was this pig farmer in British Columbia, which is a province in Canada, who basically would kidnap and like imprison and then eventually murder indigenous, generally working girls, like people who you know, were sort of a lower class. But he would pick up these girls on highways or wherever. And, you know, he did this for a long time and it went unnoticed. You know, even though there were like family members who asked police, it just like pretty much went unnoticed because of the type of people that were getting taken. And so Pig Girl basically follows this story, and there's a character in it whose only title is Pig Girl. And she is one of the indigenous women who had been taken by this man, and it shows her like crazy struggle. Like it's almost hard to talk about, you know, the things that she went through. And it's so interesting to me because it is this really crazy, powerful play that makes you think about the indigenous experience in Canada, but it also isn't written by an indigenous playwright. So I still don't know where I stand on that play because it is, it's powerful, but yeah, like.
Well, yeah. I think this is something I'm always a little confused about, and because I never know quite how to handle this sort of collective white leftist guilt.
Yeah,
I never quite know how to like address it because it's like, well, you mean like there is something to say about that from the white point of view or white colonialist point of view, or even a white resistance point of view to that. And I don't think that's illegitimate. I mean, I think it takes a certain amount of research to do and to capture things accurately, but it sounds like this playwright did that.
Yeah.
And I may get in trouble for this from some of my comrades, but I don't necessarily think it's bad when white writers or white playwrights write people of color in some sort of experience, as long as they collaborate, as long as they don't say, this is what this is. You have to do it this way. There's no other way that these people are. Because that's happened in the past a lot. Yeah. I've had to go through that a lot, I think, as a working actor. Mm-hmm. But then there are other filmmakers or other playwrights or other theater directors who kind of come at it from a more collaborative point of view, saying, no, I want to hear what you like. What are the holes in this story? Tell me.
Yeah.
Like, what did I miss? Like, what are the subtleties that aren't there? And then you collaborate and work together. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there needs to be more of that because I don't believe in censoring anybody, but like I do want there to be a more concerted effort on people who've had the privileges in the past to kind of bring in communities that have not been as privileged.
For sure. And I think that it's super important to be able to talk about it, you know, like I know people and this comes from like a good place, but they feel like they don't even want to talk. Like they don't even have a right to talk about, you know, like Chicano theater, or like an Octo Room this comes from a really good place. Like they don't want to offend anybody, but at the same time, it's like, you need to be a part of this conversation. Like if you aren't a part of this conversation, you are never going to get educated properly, because if you aren't willing to ask your questions, if you aren't willing to understand, because, you know, like you need to be able to ask those questions. I think sometimes on the left, people punish people for genuinely just not knowing, for not having been experienced, been exposed to this world, to these experiences. You know, like I grew up in a very sheltered neighborhood and I had a fairly sheltered life, and like, It was through education and conversations and reading that I was able to learn, and you know, being able to have those conversations with people who didn't chastise me and make me feel like I was a horrible person for just trying to learn, for trying to be able to better myself, and understand, you know, how, you know, BIPOC communities and BIPOC people feel, within this world, in this country, Canada as well. Like, I think it's important that you need to be a part of those conversations.
Yeah, I think that it is important. I also think a lot of my comrades of color kind of make this mistake, because there is a sense of, well, you know what? It's not my job to educate a white person or white communities. There's a lot of literature out there. You go do it. I'm not going to do this for you. And it's kind of like, well, I understand that point of view, but my fear in that is, well, but if you don't talk about it, they may learn it from the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah.
You know, they might learn it from a right-wing think tank or, like, you know, Tucker Carlson or something like that. And we don't want that. You know what I mean? Because we're living in an age of, you know, misinformation or, you know, quote-unquote fake news and all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And we also have a very considered effort to erase history, mm-hmm. In a way that I haven't seen in my lifetime. Like, I mean, it's a crazy amount of trying to just dismantled so much of the progress that was made, because in some sense the Reagan Revolution never ended.
Yeah,
I mean it's 40 years now into the Reagan Revolution, and they've done a very good job of dismantling a lot of the work that was done in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah,
and so I think there has to be some sort of engagement with people, with, because I also know people I remember I had a friend of mine a couple of years ago. She we were as a group of us, and she was talking, and we were talking about, like, queer theater, and she mm-hmm. genuinely said, like, can you tell me what queer means? Cause I'm not sure what that means. And it was like, oh, okay, sure. Like, yeah. Well, we could talk about that. But it wasn't coming from a vindictive place. It was just coming from a place I was like, okay, sure, let's talk about that. And then the same friend, we talked also about, issues about, you know, black, brown, and indigenous people at the Actors Studio. And she says, oh, I don't think they were racist. And I was like, well, it's a strong word. And that's not maybe the appropriate word, but it's like, there was a very big commitment to only teaching European and European American history and European and European American theater. And yeah. It's very problematic when you're living in a multicultural society, a multicultural city. It's not really preparing you for the working conditions you're going to be facing when mm-hmm. you're working in a multicultural society.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I feel like, I don't feel like it should be, you know, minority communities to responsibility to educate white people. Like, we have a responsibility to educate ourselves. And, you know, I personally have, done my best, but, like, I'm still constantly learning, you know, and, like, I also find that generally, you know, in these conversations, when somebody doesn't understand something, or it's not like, you know, like if you're having a conversation with a person of color about these issues, they are generally very understanding. You know, you can talk to them and genuinely, you know, like if you don't understand, I find, like, sometimes obviously not, but like by and large, they're cool with explaining it to you. Find the people who get upset at you for not knowing are white women. Like,
and that's a whole
episode. Yeah. I'll be here again next week, and we'll be discussing white women.
I think that's really true, actually.
Yeah.
I think if we're being just candid about it.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. I think a lot of us are not being candid these days, and mm-hmm. it has this tiptoeing around issues, which is frustrating for everybody.
Yeah.
I have an ex-girlfriend of mine. She's teaching theater history, and she was teaching The Colored Museum by George C. Wolfe. And there's no way to talk about that play and be politically correct. You know, there's no nice way to talk about the things he explores in that play. And if we don't have an honest conversation about it, and a brutal conversation even sometimes, we can't change things. We can't really address the elephant in the room. But I'm also sort of fascinated that, there's almost a self-censorship in people that's been being ingrained in them. And I think that's really bad for artists when they're trying to express, truthfully.
Yeah. I mean, like, like the problem of, like, white guilt, and just like virtue signaling coming out of that, are, and like just the idea of like the white savior complex, it's just so dangerous. And I feel like, you know, we need to educate ourselves, but also let these conversations be run by BIPOC people, you know, by the minority communities, like queer communities, that they should be the ones running the discussion and we should be the ones listening. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people, you know, struggle, a lot of white people struggle with their white guilt and, you know, they don't know really what to do with it. And it ends up, you know, I think hurting them more than helping them.
Well, yeah, it's a strange thing because, and there's no universal like agreement on this in mm-hmm. terms of how to deal with that. But I've just always found it kind of personally confusing. I'm like, well, mm-hmm. that's, you know, because, like I'll have like white leftist friends like who like have events and I'm like, well, where's the, you know, the white working class here? And they're like, oh, the rednecks? Why would we want to? I'm like, well, I mean, they're the proletariat. They're the working class. I mean, we can't, you know, talk about any revolutionary activity if we don't talk about the white working class. And so it's a weird, like, guilt feeling that can sometimes come across as condescension.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I don't need you to feel sorry for me. I need you to not harm me. I need you to listen to me and just, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, let me say my story because yours has been told. I'm not saying it's illegitimate. I'm not saying you can't tell it. I'm just saying I would like that opportunity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of, I don't know why we're not there yet because I think we've categorized ourselves. I'm sorry. I'm taking over the conversation.
No.
But we're so obsessed in our culture, especially in the West now, maybe particularly in America, where we want to radically categorize everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it reinforces the sense of identity politics, which is fine, and I'm not against it. But what I'm saying is that we can't also forget class struggle. We also mm-hmm. can't, you know, we have to address a number of other things that actually unite us in solidarity rather than say, well, this is why I'm different from you and you'll never understand.
Yeah. And those struggles, are so intertwined, that it really is. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a motorcycle.
Yeah. but you made the point about, you know, like having a communist event without the white working class. It just gave me the irony of the bourgeoisie putting together a communist revolution, exactly. You know? it's like, oh, we'll incorporate the proletariat later.
We'll see. You are listening to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. We are here with actor Andrew James Young. We are going to take a quick break and we will go into my favorite portion of the show. And here is a little of the hallucination. You are listening to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Hey! Showing living by the G code. What the fuck is Fleek though? Don't ask them, what do he know? What I forgot is better than whatever they remember. Never mind, I'm off it, it's quiet form. Time to put the temper tantrum to the quiet corner. Hush, that's enough, said the ruler. No suckers allowed to break bread or asunder. The daylight, lightning and the thunder. Sun, moon, and stars and the hunger. Abundance in bundles, blessings in troubles. Towers and tunnels, views and valleys, waves and peaks. Streets you from sun, planet Earth. And ain't scared of no Mars attack. What type of bars is that? Stay off my chat. I'm out there calling riot garments. Top five dying on and on them. Super fly, slicker top bro. Equals diving on them. You why you lying, homie? You won't play with my emotions, smoking. Big chief, heart rate, big beat, B-E-Y, I seen straight jacket, come clean, big said it was a dream, now it's a living thing, with you and living kings, I mean it, y'all seen in the R-E-B, I mean it, original nation, whoop on solid, I mean it, straight jacket, come clean, y'all see.
This, of course, is the jingle to Inside the Actor's Studio, created by the late, great James Lipton, who was an indirect mentor of mine. And yours, I suppose, Andrew.
A little.
A little bit, yeah. And now we move on to my favorite portion of the program, the Proust Questionnaire, devised, not necessarily invented, by Marcel Proust, adapted for television by the French talk show host Bernard Beevil, and of course perfected by the late, great James Lipton of Inside the Actor's Studio. Andrew, what is your favorite word?
Oh, man, I see. I should have thought about this before I came on. I'm going to go with... What's a fun word?
We're a little short on time. So
yeah, my favorite word is, I don't know, banality.
What is your least favorite word?
My least favorite word is probably like moist.
What turns you on?
What turns me on? A good conversation, a good flirty conversation that has intellectual sides.
What turns you off?
Turns me off? Idiots.
What sound or noise do you love?
Oh, the sound of water, like water lapping up against the beach. Oh.
What sound or noise do you hate?
Oh, fucking car horns. And this city is the worst.
Yeah, it's a rough city for that.
Yeah.
What is your favorite curse word?
Ooh, so this might be controversial, but I'm a big fan of cunt. I'm a big fan of cunt. I think it's a very sharp word, and it is like the only curse word now that is actually a curse word.
It's very British.
Yeah. I'm very inspired by UK and UK comedy.
Yeah. What profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
So I think if I, it would be either, and these are very, very different. I would be very interested in international humanitarian law. Or working as an arborist. I worked a bit as an arborist, and it was just, it's just fun, man. It's just fun.
What profession would you absolutely not like to attempt?
Something to do with sewage.
And finally, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say to you when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Oh. You know, I think I'd... Honestly, you know what? I'll go a little bit comedic with this. I'd like God to pass me a joint and say, it's time to light up.
Quickly, tell us what you have going on and where our listeners can find out more information about you and your projects.
So the only thing I can truly plug right now is the pilot for a TV show called The Interrogation Unit, which my filmmaking partner and I co-wrote and co-directed with actors from the Actors Studio Drama School. Our goal is to make it to Tribeca. The show is called The Interrogation Unit. I don't know if I just said that. It's a cool show that subverts the detective mystery genres and makes it into something incredibly silly.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. That does it for us this week. Please tune in next Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to close out with the little James Brown. This has been Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn.